Hello, this is the trimmed down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life. Maybe the first track they ever heard, the first track they may have brought, and several tracks that mark moments in their life, as well as one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for future. My guest today is Tom Walker, who is a freelance radio journalist, producer, PR consultant, and much more besides. In Tom's Tracks of My Life, we start with his early school days at Wavertree Blind School in Liverpool, then off to Worcester College for the Blind, now New College Worcester, and then to his early career days in Guildford. If you have listened to Tom's podcast series, That'll Be the Day, you will certainly know how much music plays a part in his life. Through Tom's Tracks of My Life, we will certainly go on a musical journey. Oh, and with a couple or so great concert performances along the way too. Hello, Tom, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you, Toby.
From listening to your podcast, That'll Be the Day, I know you're a big fan of music, Tom. And I wondered, how did you find it selecting your tracks?
Fairly straightforward, if I'm going to be absolutely honest, because, for instance, my first track, and I won't spoil the surprise, that's kind of indelibly inscribed in my memory and the incident that I'll talk about. And then I guess the only problem was eliminating about a million other tracks, to be honest. I mean, music, for, you know, like so many other people, that has been the backdrop to my life, really. It's provided solace and inspiration and just kept me going on occasions as well.
And that first track which you have chosen is All You Need Is Love by the Beatles, which I think you first heard when you were in Blackpool at the age of 4 and you got your sister to get them to play it again. Can you remember being in Blackpool at that time?
I can remember the incident quite well. We were in a coffee bar, if I remember correctly, and I think it had a few of the slot machines. And suddenly, All You Need Is Love came on, and it was summer 1968. Now, that record had actually come out in July 67, I think, if I remember correctly. So, I mean, I guess it was still quite popular. The Beatles had performed it live, and that had been seen by millions and millions of people. So I guess people were still selecting it. And I heard the opening bars of the French national anthem, and then the guy started singing, and I was just like enthralled by this record. So as it drew to its close, I basically began to throw what we call up here a wobbler and said, "Come on, I want to hear this again. I want to hear this again." And my poor sister, who's about 11 years, well, she is exactly 11 years older than me, not some or anything like that. She's exactly 11 years older than me, was dispatched to try and get this record on as quickly as possible again, because her four-year-old brother was about to go into a serious meltdown. Thankfully, she did. It's not my first memory of music. I think my first memory is Yellow Submarine by the Beatles, but that was heard in slightly more tranquil surroundings of our front room on probably junior choice or something.
Were you in Blackpool for holiday, or were you just there because, you know, somewhere near to home?
Oh yes, the tribe went to Blackpool every year in those days, I'm afraid. There wasn't anything terribly cultural about it, but you know, it has its charms, and very occasionally I go for a day out to Blackpool. And I think it, you know, joking aside, it's quite easy to look down on these places, but it has its purpose, and you know, we kind of enjoyed ourselves, I guess. It has left me with an enduring hatred of old-fashioned caravans. I'm very much a hotel or guest house kind of guy. Living rough doesn't really suit me in any way.
And do you remember much of the sort of the Blackpool scene there, with the donkeys on the beach and the, you know, the theme park and everything else?
I think so, yeah. I mean, there is somewhere, and I don't reveal this very often. I've actually got it, mercifully. There is a photograph of me, and I think it is taken in Blackpool, sitting on a donkey, on a donkey ride. You will imagine I never allow people to see this photograph. It's a source of family humiliation when it's occasionally mentioned.
The Beatles there with All You Need Is Love and fond or not so fond memories of Blackpool for you, Tom. Tom, your next track forms the soundtrack to a Wavertree blind school trip to South Wales. And I wondered if you can remember that school trip, going to Wales, and how you got on with the locals.
I can remember it vividly. The reason I've chosen this track, it's Fernando by ABBA, was that I think it had been released in the March of that year. No doubt some Nelly Know-All will correct me if I've got that wrong. But it was still being played in June 1976. And of course, people will remember that 1976 wasn't the summer of love, but it was the summer of hot weather. Mm-hmm. And it was a heat wave went on for months, quite honestly. We went to Port Maddock. And we did all the usual things, went to the beach, and I think we did go round a few museums and one thing and another. But the abiding memory of Port Maddock was playing football in the evening with a group of local guys who were probably a couple of years older than us. They were probably 13 or 14, but a very nice bunch of lads they were. And we kind of played these, you know, ridiculous England versus Wales games. And it was just, you know, it really made the holiday into something special. I mean, the teachers knew we were about to leave Wavertree to go on to Worcester. So it was kind of a little treat, I guess, for passing the exam to Worcester, which I may talk about at some point. And just, you know, a little breakaway for them as well. And it was all very relaxed. And, you know, we didn't go to bed early or anything like that. And when we did go to bed, the radios were on. I always remember a guy called Timmy Wilson, who actually had two radios. And even when they said, oh, please turn them off, Timmy, on came the radios, you know. So it was uber relaxed and a fabulous week away.
Can you hear the drums, Fernando? I remember long ago another starry night like this. In the firelight, Fernando.
Fernando by ABBA there, and memories of a great trip to Snowdonia for you, Tom. Your next track, Tom, takes you to a time just before you went off to Worcester College. And I believe maybe it was not that long after that trip to Snowdonia. What was Worcester College like back then? Because obviously it was before it became New College Worcester.
Yeah, I mean, Elton and Kiki were number one with Don't Go Breaking My Heart. And if I remember correctly, that was the number one just before I went to Worcester. So in the family household, there was a lot of stress about, you know, getting the right kit together for Worcester, the uniform, PE kit, Perkins, Brailer, and so on and so on. I remember travelling down to Worcester and parking up in the drive and thinking, oh my God, you know, this is a new experience. I'd been to the college for a weekend in the February for the assessment. And I remember thinking, oh, this is a bit of a strange old place. I mean, having an entrance exam over a weekend struck me as being a little bit odd. And, you know, the blind schools always, to me, have had that other world feeling about them, and certainly Worcester always did. But yes, I remember it well. I mean, what was Worcester like in those days? There are a number of descriptions that spring to mind. Dickensian in a lot of ways. The dormitories were Spartan, to put it mildly. I was actually in the bottom bed of a bunk bed. I mean, God, unheard of these days, really. The wardrobe was just this flimsy piece of wood that could have, you know, that would have made an MFI wardrobe look stable. We had a thin piece of carpet, and everybody went along to the washroom in the evening and the morning. There was no pastoral care or support to speak of. It was like Lord of the Flies. Bullying was endemic throughout the school. And sadly, some children left because they, well, understandably, couldn't handle it. You know, the bullying was just beyond appalling. There were one or two members of staff who were concerned about it, but it wasn't, it was never dealt with, sadly. And so luckily I was able to survive. And really, you know, having just enough sight to be able to avoid the unpleasant people who needed avoiding. There were some good people there. It wasn't all bad by any means, by the way. I mean, when I got to Worcester, there were probably two or three older guys who helped steer me through. I mean, people like, and he's still around, I'm pleased to say, Al Turnbull, who was a very good mate of ours and really helped some of the younger ones just to navigate through what was a very difficult environment. As you progress through the school, things got a little bit easier because obviously you work out the rules, if you like, the unwritten rules, how it works, the people to avoid, the people you can rely on, and you get more freedom as well. And so, you know, by about the second or third year, you know, we could leave the grounds without any restrictions. Once I looked 18, which was probably about the age of 15, I managed to find my way into a pub or two or three. And the school, you know, was relatively relaxed about that. As long as you didn't come back to college completely Brahms and Liszt, they would quite happily sort of turn their blind eye to it. So it did improve. And you know, inevitably, you know, you develop in confidence and find your friends. But 1976 was a difficult old time for the school. And for me, I mean, going to a new school like that, it seemed terribly posh. I mean, I'd grown up in the back streets of a horrible area of Manchester called Gorton, where the kids would roam the streets in gangs. And then suddenly, you know, there you are at Worcester College for the blind, and as it used to be, blind sons of gentlemen. Mm. You know, and it's a totally different, rarefied environment and just had a completely other world feel to it. And it's funny, when I go back to Worcester, I've done a couple of radio jobs myself from Worcester, and it still has that slightly odd sense to it. And it's hard to put your finger on it. It's almost like the blind schools almost operate in a vacuum, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, so those are my recollections of Worcester. Not all bad by any means. Difficult, particularly in the first couple of years. And I'll just explain why I think that is, Toby. You get a lot of children arriving into the first year from different schools. And a lot of them have been, if you like, very, very big fish in small ponds. And then suddenly they come to Worcester and it's a relatively small pond, but they are once again an insignificant fish, and there's a pecking order developing, and people are desperately trying to be at the top of the pecking order. And, you know, it's very, very hard for that to manage unless you have real proper pastoral care, which I think they do now at Worcester. But in my day, it was non-existent.
How much did music play a part in your life back then in Worcester?
Well, I mentioned Al Turnbull, and he had quite a lot of vinyl records, shows how long ago it is. So Al was a very big Beatles fan, and although obviously having been at Wavertree School for the Blind in Liverpool, I was perfectly aware of the Beatles. There was quite a lot of Beatles music I hadn't heard. So, you know, Al played that, and he always seemed to have the latest big hit in his collection. I mean, I always remember walking down the corridor and hearing Carol Bayer-Sager, "You're Moving Out Today." And I'm thinking, how on earth did Al Turnbull get his hands on that? You know, but so it did. And he was the first one. Then there was quite a few school bands, which I wasn't actually involved in, but enjoyed listening to. So, yeah, I mean, the music, sort of rock and pop, very much. We always used to listen to the charts on a Tuesday lunchtime, which was of course, when they were announced on Radio 1, which meant that we were late for lunch, which didn't go down terribly well with the teachers, some of whom didn't really approve of rock and pop anyway. In terms of teaching of music, Toby, I'm sorry to say, it was beyond appalling. We used to just sit and listen to some classical music during the lessons, and I have to say, some of us didn't behave terribly well. But, you know, so I didn't really ever develop a love of classical music, which is a shame. I mean, there are some pieces I like and listen to, but you know, it's one of the regrets. I wish I knew more about the technical dimension to music rather than just, you know, listening to it and enjoying it.
And were you a fan of Elton John back then as well?
Very much so back then, yeah. Elton John was obviously a huge star in the 70s, of course. He had released some major hits, things like Crocodile Rock and Yellow Brick Road. And, you know, even before Your Song, which I think was probably his first major hit, he'd been in a number of different bands and played with other groups. I think he was in Bluesology, if I remember correctly. So in those days, yes, a huge fan of Elton John. He was a really top artist. It's hard to imagine these days just how big he was, because, of course, now, you know, he's an older kind of guy and so on and so on. But yeah, back in the 70s, I think most of us would have been listening to Radio 1 and listening out for Elton. And then, you know, when he and Kiki got to number one, you know, all the talk was, why has it taken so long?
Elton John and Kiki D with Don't Go Breaking My Heart there. Tom, for your next track, we come to sort of time in the mid-1980s, and I think it was your last year at Worcester in 1984, and the track is Nick Kershaw's Wouldn't It Be Good. You say that this track actually would move the spirits of people. Can you explain sort of why it was such an uplifting track?
I just think, well, it's one really, I think if you listen to it, you can kind of hear that, you know, why it's uplifting. I think again, probably a difficult time for me personally. You know, 1984, I was about to leave Worcester and to, you know, having then become a fairly big fish in a small pond, I knew I was going to be moving away to a higher education or whatever that might be. And it's a very uncertain time. So this track kind of, you know, being a sort of a classic pop record, did make us feel a little bit better. I remember one incident actually where, I don't know why we did this now, it's just kind of the types of things that students do. We were in the sixth form and we got this track on the cassette and started playing it out of the window while classes were taking place. So a lot of the kids in the lower years heard this track and wondered what on earth was going on. But of course, the jolly japes went a little bit too far and somehow or other a window got smashed. So of course it was just like, what on earth were the sixth form doing? You know, it was just, so I just had that bizarre memory of Nick Kershaw, Wouldn't It Be Good, playing loudly, a window smashing, and then some caretaking staff coming up and investigating what on earth these terrible people were doing at, you know, 11 o'clock on a Thursday morning. It was just a weird, strange moment. But it kind of bookends my time at Worcester, obviously, with Elton and Kiki and then Nick Kershaw. There were lots of tracks in the middle that I really, really liked as well. I mean, we loved, you know, Pink Floyd, and I think we might hear that one later on. So, yeah, when you asked me earlier about music, of course, yes, I mean, The Wall was fantastic. I remember going to see various films related to Pink Floyd as well. But yeah, I mean, so come May, June, July in 1984 was the time to leave. I was quite sad in some respects, but you kind of know when your time is over, you know when you've got to move on. I think one of the criticisms I would make, Toby, of Worcester was that they failed to recognise that we were there during our formative years and the impact this has on you psychologically. And, you know, when we were coming to leave, it was just kind of like, right, OK, thanks, off you go. Don't darken our doors again. And of course, you know, inevitably there were reunions and we went back. And I think that kind of helped with the transition from Worcester to mainstream life. But it was a very, very uncertain time, and it would have been for all of us. And but the nice thing is that, you know, for me personally, I'm still very much in touch with some people that I was at school with. What I always found quite interesting, and I eventually did psychology as my degree, was some people just left. They got in their dad's or their mum's car and off they went and never heard of again. And I found that quite interesting. I was quite envious of them in some ways that they just decided they were going to move on. It took me 2 or 3 years to get the place really fully out of my system, in all honesty. But that record does remind me of good times. I mean, obviously in the sixth form, I mentioned earlier that I may have found my way into the odd pub or two. And certainly in the sixth form, how we say socialising. The headmaster wrote on one of my school reports, Toby, which I suspect you might find amusing. Tom would do an awful lot better academically if he spent less time in the pub. So that may give you a little clue as to how I spent quite a lot of my time. And that aspect of it was really good. I think my A-levels were what you might describe as suboptimal. And I spent a few years doing other things before going to college, but including living in Guildford, which kind of brings us on to the next track. But, you know, overall, I don't regret it. You know, I think what happened was what was meant to be, really.
The classic 80s sounds of Nick Kershaw there with Wouldn't It Be Good. We're sticking with the 80s now, Tom, for your next track with Peter Gabriel's In Your Eyes, which came from his album So. And there are probably a few obvious tracks from So that people might have chosen, like Sledgehammer or Red Rain or, you know, Don't Give Up. And I wondered why you chose this particular track from So.
Well, I entirely agree with you, Toby. There's any number of, well, there are 9 tracks on this album, I think, something like that. But, you know, I love every track on that album almost equally. I guess the only reason I really love In Your Eyes is because at the end, Yusu Endur makes an appearance. And if you've got time, you may play it right to the end. I know on these programs, sometimes it's difficult, especially when you've got somebody like me waffling away. But Yusu Endur makes an appearance and it really just adds something to the track for me. I mean, I love Sledgehammer, obviously love Red Ray, love all of those tracks. And I just remember living in a bit of a hovel, really, in Guildford, in Surrey at the time. And I got hold of this album, and again, music there just provided me with real solace and loved this album right away. You know, sometimes with an album, you listen to it and it's all right, and then it gets better and better and better, and sometimes you just think, oh, I don't want to hear that again. This album, I fell in love with it straight away, and to be honest, you know, just played and played and played, and I think at the time I had it on cassette. And I'm sure I wore out the cassette fairly quickly, just playing it over and over. But it's just a magnificent album. There aren't many albums, really, that you can honestly say are, well, I could say anyway, that are as good as this. I mean, there are one or two. I mean, I love Sinead O'Connor, who we may hear later on. But I think for me, this album is just perfection. Every track I could play over and over and over and not get bored of it. And I'm sorry to say, I often do. Reminds me of a time, as I said, when I was living in this awful place in Guildford. It was just, I mean, it defies description. I hated Guildford at the time, Toby. It just epitomised absolutely everything that was wrong with this country during the 80s. Greed was just rampant. I didn't much care for the southeast of England anyway. And being kind of stuck down there working wasn't a happy time in some ways, but musically, there was one or two good albums kicking around and one or two good tracks that I liked. Made some good friends as well, actually, despite that. And having just slagged Guildford off well and truly, I did make some good friends. And we used to go and watch the old Guildfordians rugby team and get horribly drunk afterwards, but you know, that was enjoyable.
In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel there, and that classic mid-80s sound from Peter Gabriel with his album So. Tom, we now come to Pink Floyd, which I think we have mentioned a little earlier on, and obviously The Wall. And I think you went to see Pink Floyd twice on consecutive nights at Wembley. And I wondered, firstly, why you were so enthralled with Pink Floyd.
I've just loved Pink Floyd from The Wall onwards, and probably in reality a little bit before then. But The Wall really did bring to life the brilliance of Pink Floyd. And then I started to listen to other albums, Wish You Were Here, Dark Side of the Moon, Relics, and so on and so on, and just find out more about the band, because, you know, in those days it was harder to do that. I mean, we forget, you know, nowadays that we've got Wikipedia and other easily accessible sources of information. In those days, the sleeve notes on a record, for example, would have been completely inaccessible. But nonetheless, that's what I did. And 1988, I heard on the radio or something that Pink Floyd were doing two gigs at Wembley. So I went along to one of the outlets at the time that did tickets, and I got a ticket for the Friday night. And it was really, really good. Just a fantastic performance. The sound, albeit at a football stadium, the sound was just superb, and I just loved it. And I just thought, I wonder whether I should come back on the Saturday night. I thought, well, I'm not really planning to do anything. I'll see what I think, see how I feel the next day. And then the next day came about 4 o'clock. I thought, yeah, let's go and try it, see if I can get a ticket outside. And so that's what I did. So I ran in, and I think they started, if I remember correctly, with Shine On You Crazy Diamond. I'm pretty certain now that's what it was. And literally just ran in. I've been to Wembley a few times for football, so kind of knew what I was letting myself in for. Just ran in, got on the pitch, and got as near to the front as possible. And so had two fantastic nights there. I mean, I got fairly close to the stage, and with a monocular, I was able to see the guys actually on the stage as well. But it was just, I think the Friday night gig had just been so good that I just thought, you know what, I'll just go and try and see if I can get a ticket outside.
Obviously, they must have played Comfortably Numb at Wembley when you were there.
They did, yeah. Yeah. And I think everybody just kind of, you know, to me, that was kind of like the apogee of the evening, quite honestly. You know, it's just kind of like, wow, absolutely fantastic. And you're always wondering, you know, how well they can pull it off, how well they can perform it, you know, live in relation to the album version. And, you know, they did pretty well, if I remember correctly. You know, I was impressed with the whole gig, and, you know, and they're you know, accomplished, consummate performers live, and they didn't let us down with anything, really.
Comfortably Numb there by Pink Floyd. Finally, Tom, we come to your final track. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
This is my favourite album track of all time. It's probably not one that provides a lot of hope to people, unfortunately, Toby, but it's just brilliant. It's Sinead O'Connor, Troy, from the album The Lion and the Cobra. And I got into Sinead's music in the late 80s, I'm guessing. And I went to see her live at the Manchester Apollo, and I've only ever seen her once, which is very, very sad. Fortunately, I was in the front row, and it was just a brilliant gig. And then she went off, did the encore, and did this particular track as a final track. And, you know, it's a track that is very, very powerful. People will hear the lyrics and hear that it really does depict a lot of the anguish that Sinead O'Connor feels about her early life. And the thing that really sticks with me indelibly in my memory is that being on the front row, I could see her facial expression. And as she belted out this track, I could see the contorted lines of anger and anguish in her face. And remember thinking, oh my goodness me. And again, you know, I hadn't really fully appreciated the difficulties that Sinead O'Connor had experienced in her early life. But when I heard this track, it motivated me to go and do some more reading about her, which, you know, again, in at that time was a lot more difficult than it would be now. But, you know, I came away and I just thought, oh, my goodness me, she hasn't half been through it. And just being at the front, I visually could appreciate it, as well as listening to the words and lyrics and the anger in her voice as well, the passion. And since then, I've always loved Sinead O'Connor's music, and just occasionally play some the odd album and so on. But this for me is my favourite track of all time.
Well, thank you, Tom Walker, for sharing your Tracks of My Life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're very welcome, and I hope some of the tracks at least strike a chord with your listeners.
I remember it in Dublin in a rainstorm, sitting in the long grass in summer, keeping warm.